This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyus Wohib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's a population which is amenable and open to the ideological call by these extremists. And the second thing is, this is an area where governance is weak.
That's former State Department Coordinator for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, on why Islamic extremist groups are growing in Africa. Details coming up also. 58 people have been killed when a convoy of buses were attacked in Niger. And the UN data shows the secondary effects of the COVID-19 pandemic have been particularly devastating for women and children. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Islamic State and Al-Qaeda sub-Saharan affiliates are poised for growth this year, with core ISIS and Al-Qaeda reeling from sustained Western counterterrorism campaigns. Attention has shifted from former jihadist bases in the Middle East and South Asia, respectively, to the Sahel and Nigeria, the Horn of Africa, and most recently, the southeastern Swahili coast. These affiliates throughout sub-Saharan Africa are well positioned to expand their influence, recruit, spread propaganda, and in some cases, capture territory. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former State Department Coordinator for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, discussed this threat with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
Well, of course, why are they doing this? They're doing this because there's two things. There's a population which is amenable and open to the ideological call by these extremists. And the second thing is, this is an area where governance is weak, where there are weak state structures, corruption, ineffective security services. And so they are taking advantage both of an audience, a public that they can mobilize, and basically knowing that the response is going to be not as strong as it should be. That's why the importance of building up governments and building up state structures is essential to fighting them.
Continued conflict between ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates could drive competition for prestige, recruits, and resources, leading to a process known as outbidding, where terrorist organizations ramp up operations to position themselves as the dominant entity in the country or the region. How should the African countries and the U.S.-Africa Command deal with this escalation?
Well, it's a dangerous situation. There is a deep rivalry between, you could say, the pro-ISIS and the pro-Al-Qaeda groups. In one area, one is dominant, and in another area, another is dominant. For example, there is ISIS in Somalia, but the dominant jihadist group in Somalia is the pro-Al-Qaeda one, is Al-Shabaab. Whereas, for example, in Nigeria, it's clearly the ISIS affiliate which is dominant and actually largely monopolizes the space. So there is a rivalry between them, and there is perhaps something that intelligence agencies and Western governments can do to manipulate this rivalry one against the other. But it's a very dangerous situation which can only be done with people who are really knowledgeable about the internal workings of these groups and the deep knowledge of these groups from Boko Haram and BSIM and Al-Shabaab and others is not as deep as it should be. So it's a very risky situation to try to kind of manipulate them internally through kind of intelligence work. The easier thing is to crush them militarily.
ISIS has taken advantage of porous borders, lack of security sector accountability in countries like Mali and Mozambique, working to further destabilize already fragile states in the continent. How important is to deal with the ideology, economic and political grievances in Africa to contain recruiting and spread of ISIS influence in the African continent?
Ideology is important. poverty, marginalization are important. However, it's my view that while those are real concerns and concerns that need to be addressed, the biggest problem is the lack of security, the lack of efficient law and order, the lack of a state structure that is able to impose its will on others. Of course, we want to confront the ideology. Of course, we want better, more humanistic, more pluralistic societies. We want to address the grievances of marginalized communities and of the poor and of tribalism in Africa. But the single biggest thing that we can focus on is the security situation, realizing that it's not just about security. It's not just about fighting and militaries. It's about these other things as well.
So could the withdrawal of French troops as well as a drawdown of U.S. troops as part of renewed focus on great power competition with Russia and China provide more operational space for ISIS and other terrorist groups, while simultaneously depriving local African militaries of vital security cooperation assistance?
Yes, I think that a lessening of a presence by French and U.S. forces is connected to a lessening of attention by those forces. And I think that's a very risky situation. But we do training programs. We have different forms of outreach. In West Africa, we have FLITLOC, which is a counterterrorism training experience that lasts 2 weeks with European and American forces working with local African forces. We're doing some things, but in my view, this is not the time to be cutting corners and to be cutting back. This is actually the time to look at strengthening our relationship with security and friendly militaries in the region. It's not a super expensive investment, but I think it has a high payoff in having forces fighting the extremists that are more professional and more effective. And so I think that our presence on the ground has to be continued, primarily focused on training and supporting forces, but across the board, we need to be on the ground.
That was Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former State Department Coordinator for Strategic Counterterrorism Communication, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Underscoring the dangers of the Islamist groups were two major attacks in the last 2 days in the Sahel. 58 people have been killed in a brutal attack Monday on a bus convoy in Niger. According to the French news agency AFP, groups of unidentified armed men intercepted and attacked four buses carrying passengers who had just finished shopping in Bani Bangou, a major market town just a few kilometers from the border with Mali. Niger is struggling with two jihadist campaigns in the west near Mali and Burkina Faso and a decade-old insurgency in the southeast on the border with Nigeria. The government announced 3 days of mourning starting today for the bus victims. And dozens of assailants riding motorbikes and pickup trucks attacked the army base in northern Mali, leaving 31 soldiers dead. Initial statements said yesterday only two soldiers were killed and eight wounded. The French news agency AFP, however, quoting a Malawian army officer who declined to be identified, said the death toll has risen to 31. He said the bodies of 13 assailants were found after the clash. Mali was plunged into conflict in 2012 when local Tuareg radicals, supported by jihadists, revolted in the north. France intervened to crush the rebellion, but the jihadists scattered and regrouped, taking their campaign into central Mali in 2015 and then into neighboring Niger and Burkina Faso. The United Nations Refugee Agency and partners are appealing for $1.2 billion to provide life-saving assistance for more than 2 million refugees from South Sudan. The majority of the refugees are children living in dire conditions in five neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The hopes that accompanied South Sudan's independence a decade ago have long since disappeared, pushed aside by a displacement crisis. Since civil war erupted in December 2013, nearly 2 million people have been displaced inside the country. Another 2.2 million have sought refuge in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, and Uganda. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says the South Sudan refugees are among the youngest in the world. He says more than two-thirds of them are children.
We are talking about at least 1.4 million South Sudanese refugees being children today under the age of 18. And they include some 66,000 children who have been separated from their parents.
The South Sudanese refugee crisis is the largest on the African continent. Baluch says most of the South Sudanese refugees are living in remote, underdeveloped areas in their host countries. He says they are in great need of humanitarian and protection assistance.
The COVID-19 pandemic combined with the climate change-related challenges, including severe flooding, droughts, and desert locusts, have compounded an already dire situation. Funding is urgently needed to provide life-sustaining assistance, including shelter, access to safe drinking water, education, and health services.
Baluch notes food rations have had to be cut for hundreds of thousands of refugees because of lack of money. He says the pandemic is taking a heavy toll on socioeconomic conditions for both refugees and host communities. He warns conditions will continue to deteriorate for this vulnerable population without generous international support. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Sudan refugees living in Uganda have decried cuts in food rations, saying they are not getting enough to get through the month. The cuts have been blamed for an increase in thefts and violence in refugee settlements. At the beginning of February, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, reduced food rations to the 1.26 million refugees in Uganda by 40% due to funding shortages. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Refugees say the cuts in their monthly rations of rice, maize, grains, sorghum and beans can only last about half that time and have left many on the verge of starvation. Gloria Opani is a South Sudan refugee in Bidibidi settlement.
The children, they have come from Sudan when they are orphans. Some of them came with their mothers, but they lose it from here. Again, taking care of themselves is too difficult for them. So the same food they are giving each person is for 2 months. If you don't have anywhere to do, you don't have anywhere or somewhere back home to support you, that food is not enough.
Moses Wenga is a refugee welfare officer in the Bidibidi settlement. He says some refugees have resorted to stealing food from their neighbors and the host communities to meet their families' needs.
The theft cases has happened. A woman goes and steals a bean from a neighbor house because she has many children. Some of us, we don't have a field. We don't have even a land to supplement the little food that we got from UNSARA.
Others are making back and forth journeys to their home countries in search for food. The long journeys are risky, and their home countries are still unstable. Richard Modi is a South Sudan refugee in Uganda.
Without the permission of OPM or UNHCR, many have decided to just do a voluntary repatriation. Someone decide to walk back.
Solomon Osakan is a refugee welfare officer in the West Nile region. He says there are forecasts of further cuts in food rations in the coming months if no new funding partners come on board.
They are going to continue to reduce food again by 10%. So the food that refugees are going to get is going to be like each person 6.8 kilos of maize for a month.
Osakan has urged refugees to utilize the small available pieces of land to grow supplementary cereals and vegetables. WFP says it will need $77 million through August to provide full rations. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says cuts in rations or cash are undercutting coping strategies for refugees to meet their basic food needs. Some are skipping or reducing meals or selling assets while their children are pushed into work for food. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
A recent rise in COVID-19 cases in Africa and much of the rest of the world is raising concerns that the third wave of the coronavirus pandemic is rising. VOA Africa's Lenerok Dumudu talked with Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General, about what the new variants of the COVID-19 mean for the future of fighting the deadly disease.
How do you assess the COVID response in Africa?
I think the COVID response is going okay. The first wave was better for our continent, for Africa, actually. The second phase was more serious. That started in January 2021. And then there was a period of starting from late January, started to decline. And now we see some tendency again to increase. I think the focus from this, what we can understand is that the focus on the basic public health measures should continue. We need to do the basic things like what we have been doing, you know, the use of masks, you know, the physical distancing, the hand hygiene, and we need to continue to do that. And we need to continue our surveillance also. We need to find where the virus is try to address, attack it, continue to attack. So continuing with the public health measures will be important. But I have some concern that there is a slight increase now. It's not a significant one, but the tendency should be taken seriously. But this is not just for Africa alone. If you see the global trend, it was declining until mid-February. And now we can see the last 3 weeks, some slight increase. So the trend globally and in Africa is almost the same, with a slight trend in the, you know, on the increase. This could be explained in many ways. As I said, maybe some countries are lowering their guard, that they have to be very careful. Second, it could be the variant, and there could be other issues. So we have to understand why. But at least we have to continue to implement the proven public health measures while addressing the other additional challenges we're facing.
How concerned should we be about the variants? How much of an impact are they having on the global strategy?
We have to be really concerned because the concern we have is, of course, there is a variant report from the United Kingdom, South Africa, and Brazil. But one question is, are these the only variants we have? And the other question is, you know, whatever number of variants we have, you know, are the vaccines we have now really effective? And then the third question is, you know, how is the behavior of the virus changing with the changing variants? Is it becoming more lethal, or is it becoming less? So I think continuing to understand, the variants is very important, starting from the surveillance, to find out as early as possible when we have variants, understand what their behavior is in terms of their transmissibility and severity of disease. And then we have to understand also in terms of the effectiveness of the vaccines that we use. And we have a network now that's coordinated by WHO, and we're trying to strengthen the surveillance system.
That was Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General, speaking with VOA Africa's Lenok Mudu. South Africa's Regulatory Authority for Medicines has granted emergency approval of the COVID-19 vaccine made by the Pfizer drug company. Citizens hope this will finally begin an immunization program that recently shuddered to a halt when tests showed the AstraZeneca jab, which was about to be rolled out, wasn't as effective as hoped against the variant prevalent in South Africa. Scientists are currently giving the Johnson & Johnson or J&J vaccine to health workers, but only as part of a trial because it is awaiting official approval. Darren Taylor reports.
The co-leader of the J&J trial in South Africa, Dr. Linda Gail Becker, helped negotiate the special use agreement of a million of the firm's shots.
They've had to be gathered from all around the world, which is where the clinical trials were run. And they've been brought back to Europe, relabeled, and then sent through to us here in South Africa. J&J is working very hard to do this, but the doses are coming to us in limited consignments. But essentially, you know, we are moving towards the 200,000 dose mark now. And every single one of those, we've been able to get into the arms of South Africans. So healthcare workers.
But the infectious diseases expert acknowledges this is nowhere near the needs of the country suffering Africa's worst COVID-19 outbreak.
There is no national vaccine rollout without vaccines, right? So the big problem in the world today is a global shortage of COVID-19 vaccines. And hopefully the Pfizer doses are on their way. That will kickstart the national rollout per se. And what I can
tell you, Becker says some of the criticism of the government for not procuring vaccines fast enough has been unfair.
The problem is, you know, we need to vaccinate effectively the globe. That is a large number of people, and it means a great number of manufacturing capabilities need to be brought on hand. And my understanding is, around the world, we just don't have sufficient manufacturing capability. And Dr. Fauci, who I interviewed,
she says when South Africa is finally able to get enough vaccines, it'll be ideally placed to run an efficient mass rollout because of its experience in dealing with HIV. South Africa has the most confirmed HIV infections in the world at 8 million. It has responded with the globe's largest HIV drug distribution program, giving free antiretroviral treatment to about 5 million people every month.
It has largely fallen to HIV doctors to pivot to COVID, and that has been partly because we're in the space of working on viruses. We, you know, are every day thinking about antiviral agents and how to manage epidemics.
Becker's been trying to find a vaccine for HIV for 3 decades.
We've been trialing new innovation for HIV for many years now. So we have the infrastructure and the expertise. And so when COVID came along, it was just almost natural to say, well, I have to roll up my sleeves and see what I can do regarding this pandemic.
In that context, she finds it amazing that COVID-19 vaccines have been developed less than a year after the pandemic became clear.
What has been disappointing on some levels has been seeing the same kind of difficulty in accessing what might be considered public good commodity. I think there is some importance to have a kind of a fairness around the dose procurement, which I think we have not seen in this pandemic. You know, there was a scramble and a bun fight for vaccines, and poorer countries have suffered as a result.
The South African government says it's bought 20 million Pfizer doses, although most will only be available at the end of April. But it hopes to receive almost 120,000 doses from the World Health Organization's global vaccine program, COVAX, within weeks. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swohib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.